this week, we're having a look at the third chapter of Bhikkhu Bodhi's Inner Buddha's Words. These three things, monks, are conducted in secret, not openly. What three? Affairs with women. Presumably the Buddha wasn't speaking personally here. Mantras of the Brahmins and wrong view. But these three, monks, shine openly, not in secret. What three? The moon, the sun, and the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata. That particular phrase from the Anguttara. Sorry? Ah, yeah, sure. Okay, no worries, yeah. Yeah, there are actually a couple of the suttas today from the Majjhima. So the next reading here is the Kalama Sutta, very famous one. So here's the Chinese correspondences, only one corresponding sutta, and this Pali is in the Anguttara. Chinese corresponding sutta is in the Madhyama Agama of the
insert Chinese speaking people here.
Of the which school?
What?
Madhyama Agama. Any other guesses?
WBO?
Pentecostal? any other suggestions? Majjhima Agama. We've done like 2 years of readings from the Majjhima Agama. Every week. Sarvasivada. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
I was just seeing whether anyone else was going. Sarvasivada, and here's Tanisaro's translation. Okay, so I might as well read from Tanisaro's translation. So we've got here. But is that okay? Shall we pull that blind a bit further down and make it a bit darker in here, or is that okay?
So whereabouts
are they? Sarvasivada is from Kashmir. Into Tibet, yeah. But they're probably originally from Mathura.
But the idea of the school of the
Yeah. The other, that's right, yeah. Very good. We'll tell you how the class is going, all right?
Where are the Mahasanghikas?
Mahasanghikas were kind of distributed all around.
So they were around.
Yeah.
Kind of nice.
Yeah, and they had sub-schools everywhere. Like the Bamiyan Buddhas were Mahasanghika.
So they kind of
in Afghanistan.
Together, yeah. We don't have any of the
That's right, yeah. Okay. But also, the Mahasanghikas were also in Andhra Pradesh.
Oh, okay.
It's on the east coast, yeah. So all the way from, at least from Andhra Pradesh to Afghanistan, so that's already quite long there. Yeah. Okie dokie. So, anyway, just, I don't know, I was very trying to read this thing, but. He's got this thing, I've heard that on one occasion. Don't believe it, everybody. Right? It's wrong. Everybody's right. It's, thus have I heard. Full stop. On one occasion. Okay? And that's proven by a particular quote in the Digha Nikaya, which proves the syntax without doubt. I have heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One, on a wandering tour among the Kosalans with a large community of monks, arrived at Kesaputta, a town of the Kalamas. Okay, so it's in the Kosalan country, ruled by King Pasenadi, capital is Savatthi. Kalamas, heard it said, Samana Gautama, son of the Sakyans, having gone forth from the Sakyan clan, has arrived at Kesaputta, and of that master Gautama, who his fine reputation has spread. Interesting, this little idiom here, when it says it's he's the son of the Sakyans, because normally the term son of the Sakyan is actually used to mean the, in a sense, of the sons of the Buddha. So here the Buddha himself is called the Sakyaputta. So obviously it doesn't mean son of the Buddha, it means belonging to the Sakyan clan. Now, a good report about the Master Gautama has been circulating thus. That blessed one is an arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons, to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. Having realized with his own direct knowledge this world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, he makes it known to others. He teaches a Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. With the right meaning and expression, he reveals a spiritual life that is perfectly complete and purified. Now it is good to see such arahants. So here Venerable Tamisro is using the translation, literal translation of an arahant is a worthy one. Okay, so this of course all the stock phrase. Then the Kalamas went to see the Buddha, and this is quite cute, a passage. Some paid homage to him and sat down on one side, some exchanged greetings with him, and after their greetings and cordial talk sat down to one side, some saluted him reverentially and sat down to one side, some remained silent and sat down to one side. Okay, so all the different responses, there wasn't a uniform feeling, and that's always the kind of a depiction when it's like people are inquiring, they haven't quite made up their mind, they're not antagonistic, but they're not quite sure if they're taking the Buddha as their teacher. Or Venerable Sir, Santi Bhante, notice how they address the Buddha as Bhante. There are certain ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta, explain and elucidate their doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. We just saw on Amazon the same thing's going on today. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of the others. For us, Venerable Sir, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood. And the Buddha replied, "It is fitting for you to be perplexed, O Kalamas. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has risen in you about a perplexing matter." Okay, so this is the Buddha's response here. And again, just notice characteristic this is of the Buddha's response. He's not, as a religious teacher, he's not saying there's something wrong with you because you've got doubt. Yeah? He's actually saying it's right. Doubt is right. It actually is a doubtful matter. Yeah? And so Buddha's response, alanghi, or alang, it is enough, it's sufficient. Kankitong, alang viti kichitong, kankar. Kankha is literally like whatness. Vitikicha. Kankha literally, literal basis of kankha is always like whatness. What? What the? And vitikicha is the base of that is, how do I fix this? It's a reduplicative desiderative reduplication of a root to mean to cure something. So it's meaning I want to cure it, but I don't quite know how to. It's enough. Come. And the Bodhi's translation. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition or by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by collection of texts, by logic, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our teacher. And this is, of course, the most central passage here. Has anyone got a glass of water?
No,
we don't have water. Would someone be able to get me some... Maybe a jug? Kim? Thanks.
Bhikkhu Bodhi says this is one of the most misquoted suttas.
Bhikkhu Bodhi is not the only one. Yeah. I also say this is one of the misquoted suttas. They did a whole Closer to Reality seminar a couple of years ago on this passage. Yeah. We should get... I don't know if we still have our Kalama Sutta poster. We have. We can compare how it's printed. And anyway, so this is for anybody who's coming to modern Buddhism, this is one of the absolutely central passages, right? And it's like almost like the selling point for modernist Buddhism. It's like saying this is the Buddha's charter for free inquiry. There it is, right? The Buddha said don't believe and all of these things. And so it's become very, very prominent in modernist Buddhism, and it became so because of the promotion of this particular passage mainly by a generation of Sri Lankan teachers. So that whole kind of generation, like Kesari Dhammananda, Narada, the kind of mid-20th century kind of Dhamma promotion, and trying to present Dhamma as a rational, reflective, inquiring teaching. And so this, of course, was... It was, you know, always to remember that it would have hardly been known at all in traditional Buddhist circles, and still would be. And if you went to Thailand to a village and said to the people, you know, well, we're practicing according to the Kalama Sutta, they've never heard of it. They don't know what you're talking about. Don't go by tradition. But in bringing this forward, has of course done the very great service. Thanks very much, Kim. Of encouraging that spirit of inquiry and all of those things, so it's been very positive. But in the course of that, the sense of the text has often been largely lost, and you find that it's translated very loosely and without much actual reference to the little details like the meaning of the Pali words and things like that. The passage itself about these things is a stock one, and is found in many, many suttas, not just the Kalama Sutta, but this is the most famous context in modern times anyway that it occurs in. So we'll just go through each one of these phrases one by one. That's an isolated phrase. So the first one, Ma Anusavena. Alright? Ma anusavena. Anu means along with. Sava is the root to hear. Okay? So not to hear, not by hearing from another. Okay? This is the first one. And this relates to the line, if you're familiar with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where the Buddha says, Pubbe ananusute sutamesu, regarding dhammas that were not heard before from another. It's the same word. Okay? So this is his true idea of direct insight, not by hearing. This is the idea of, you know, Chinese whispers kind of thing. It's not very politically correct, is it? In China, I think they call it something else. So not by hearing from another.
Because I'd like to claim Chinese verbs.
Yeah? Yeah, that's all right, okay.
Indian
Sutta,
it's called Indian
Sunburn. Okay?
Okay.
And there's Soena. So Taneshiro has reports, Bhikkhu Bodhi has oral tradition. Either one is probably okay, or probably oral tradition may be a bit more specific. That's Anusavena is report, oral tradition Bhikkhu Bodhi has. Parampara, parang means on or beyond something. So parampara means on and on, right? On and on. And it's usually the word that's used to mean lineage. So when we discuss, for example, like the Vinaya lineage in a Sangha context, the Pali word is parampara. Okay, so it's on and on and on, a continual on and onness. So here, Taneshiro has legends, a bit vague there. What is Bhikkhu Bodhi as often much more to the point, by lineage of teaching. Okay, so this is the idea that it's a passing down from one to one of a particular teaching. Okay, ma iti giraya, traditions, and again a bit vague here, Taneshiro, and also Bhikkhu Bodhi here also a bit vague, hearsay, traditions and hearsay, neither of those really capture it. What this literally means, iti means thus, gira means seems. Okay, that's a literal translation. It seems thus, right? That's a literal translation, but probably what the meaning here is, you have this kind of idiom for ancient literature in Pali or Sanskrit. You have this kind of itihasa, thus it was, and I think it's also perhaps what the original meaning of itiwuttaka was, thus was spoken, itihasa, itikira, thus it was, and this I think would be, means legends of the past. Okay, so I think that's what the idiomatic meaning of this is. The literal translation is, it seems thus. Okay, but the kira is often used in relating stories of like legends and so on of the past. So they'll kind of introduce it when they're introducing a backstory for something, like a legendary backstory or something like that. They use the particle kira. It seems that this was the case, you know, and sort of introduces, it's a bit like once upon a time or something like that. So that's what I think is referred to here. Ma pitaka sampada nena, not by scripture, again a little bit okay, but a little bit vague, not by collection of texts, Bhikkhu Bodhi has. So here pitaka, literal meaning basket, so obviously became the word used for a collection of texts, presumably because you would it would seem to be that, I mean, it's an interesting idiom because it would seem to me the meaning that you put a bunch of manuscripts and you put them in a basket would seem to be the thing, but they didn't do that in the Buddha's day, so where the actual metaphor came from is a matter for speculation. Sampadana is like inclusion or collection of those things. So not by inclusion or collection in a pitaka. So this is probably the earliest use of the word pitaka, the use of it as a term for a collection of Buddhist scriptures isn't found in the canon itself, as far as I'm aware. So not by inclusion in your canonical scriptures. Ma taka hetu. Okay. By taka hetu, and here Bhikkhu Bodhi has logic, and Taneshiro has by logical conjecture, and my feeling is that here, where you're starting to get a bit of a kind of a programmatic translation here by Taneshiro, by use of the word conjecture, he's kind of implying that it's like a baseless speculation. That implication is not found in the word itself. Taka hetu means a root or a cause, and it's a logical term. For the premises of an argument, and taka just meaning logic. Okay, so taka by itself doesn't have any sort of negative connotations. No? It just means logic.
The postcards and greeting cards I've seen that one of the sutras written on, I'm really interested. This one out.
Yeah. or they say something even more programmatic, like not by spurious reasoning or something like that. This doesn't actually say that. So this one, naya hetu, again the idea hetu here is reason, and naya inferential reasoning. So Tanisra has by inference, so both of those are quite good translations. Naya means like leading out, so almost like from leading out from one to one, so inference is quite a good rendering of that. Hetu is a logical term. It's a technical term used in logic, meaning, and it's used in logic for the premise. Yeah. This. You could translate it very literally as by leading out from a premise.
Yeah.
Ma akara parivitakena. Okay. And Tanisra here has by analogies, which is kind of interesting. I'm not sure where he got that from. Normally, there are specific words in Pali to mean by analogy. Bhikkhu Bodhi has by reasoned cogitation. Okay. Now, this particular one is not obvious how to translate it, and it seems that as we're going along, we're getting a bit more sophisticated. You know, we started out with the more kind of basic ones. It's just what I heard from somebody. Yeah, oh, I heard this, and then oh, it's embodied in the tradition or in the legends. It's included in the canonical scriptures. If we go further, it's getting a bit kind of more hardcore. Akara parivitakena. This one was, and so notice that parivitaka is actually the same root taka as we had up here, takahetu, but the pari and vi. Vitaka, obviously we know, is one of the jhana factors, is thinking. In ordinary context, it usually means thinking, not in samadhi context. Pari means all around. Right? So akara parivitakena. Parivitaka means like contemplating all around something, thinking all around, reflecting all around something. So it's more intensive, reflective than just a straight taka. And akara is an interesting word. The basic meaning of akara is aspect or feature or part. Okay, so this, for example, the 32 parts of the body are 32 akaras. Okay, 32 aspects of the body, if you like. 32. I was referring to Buddhaghosa's list of 32.
But you did make that clear, that was the problem.
Well, I assumed that everybody knew that if I was referring to the 32 parts. Okay. Just think, for those of you who are not particularly up on that particular controversial issue, in the suttas it usually has 31 parts of the body, and in later lists they added the brain, and that became 32. I think it's in the latest part of the canon as well, actually. Okay. Akara parivita. Okay, so akara can mean... One possible meaning of this, and I had some discussion about this with Bhikkhu Bodhi when he was doing his Sanyutta translation, and I said, doesn't akara mean aspects? So akara parivitaka, I thought, would most logically mean just reflecting or contemplating on all the different aspects of something. Yeah, so it's like a thorough contemplation of all the different aspects of a problem or something like that. And he wrote back and pointed out that in Jayati Leka's book on early Buddhist
theory of knowledge,
yeah, thank you. He's studied this in quite some depth and showed that akara here means reason or cause. Okay. So this is the meaning here, by reflection or cogitation. Everybody has reasoned, so by reasoned or by reasoning on causes or something like that.
Okay. So reasoning about the causes of something?
Yeah, something like that. Going back, like reflecting on by inquiring back into the causes of things, or something along those lines. Reasoned cogitation. So, this passage has been studied in quite some depth. It's a very important passage for early Buddhist epistemology. So if you're interested to look at it in more detail, Jati Leka's book, Early Buddhist Theories of Knowledge, is the classic study, one of the most outstanding products of 20th century Buddhist studies. Karapaibhutakena. Ma, of course, meaning not, don't. Ma dipi nidhana hantiga. So this is a nice little phrase et here. Dipi nidhana kanti. Okay, so dipi is a view. Nidhana is jhana is jhana, right? The word we know of as jhana, as in jhana night jhana. Nidhana means basically down, and it can have two implications here. It's often used in a negative sense, so as in nibbana, right? No wind or whatever it is, no air. So it's a negative sense, but it can also have, it's like an intensive or something sense. It can have different senses. This comes up in discussions of the question of whether you can have arahants without jhanas. There are certain passages where these kind of arahants are described, I think, in the commentaries as being nidhana. And then there was this discussion about whether nidhana means they are without jhanas, yeah, or more likely, actually what it's used in the same meaning as here. It's got nothing to do with jhana as such, but what it means is it's a idiomatic usage meaning to ponder, okay? So in other words, we're ponderers. So it's not saying we don't have jhanas, it's saying we are ponderers, you know, we're ones who reflect or about the Dhamma or something like that. It's this usage of jhana in this sense is not dissimilar to certain forms which are described of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva when he returns from his journey out and sees the four signs. Yeah? So when he sees the old man, the sick man, the dead man and the monk, he goes back to the palace and then he like broods or ponders. Yeah? And so it uses these words like nidhana. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same form, but similar words from jhana. From jhana. What it means is like it's almost like to churn something over inside you, you know, to sort of, you know, intensely intense contemplation. Yeah, almost like can be almost like depressive brooding in that context. Yeah, so yeah, kind of obsessing about it. Yeah.
Doesn't this mean having accepted a view after pondering it?
Yeah, I'm getting to the acceptance bit. Yeah. So that's the nidhana. It has this idea of, like, you know, continually turning something over and so it's translated by pondering, which is probably quite good. Kanti, we most commonly know in its meaning of patient endurance or patience, but here it has a meaning which is quite a common meaning of acceptance. Okay. So acceptance or Bhikkhu Bodhi often uses, no, here he's using acceptance, he uses acquiescence, I think, by agreement through pondering views. Agreement's not such a, Tennis Rose translation's always a bit awfully, but Bhikkhini Jhana Kanti, and that's important to know that, because you'll find very frequently, and as far as I'm aware, universally in the Chinese tradition, that kanti is mistranslated as patience. I can't remember what the Chinese character is, but it occurs in various things like the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva path and things like that, where he has a kanti, and it's always translated as a patience of such and such. And it sounds very weird to read it in English, but what does it mean to patience? It means an acceptance of. Yeah, so he's not patienting. It says like a patient of a view. It's the same sense as this, but what it means is an acceptance.
So I in a way like the translation of acceptance rather than patience,
yeah,
because
yeah.
It has a more like say, for instance, well,
maybe you can't change the situation, so you accept it rather than being patient about it. Patient means that there's still in a sense of resistance to it.
Yeah.
Acceptance means it's like a surrendering, that you take this on board and you accept that this is the way it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Patience still means that you really wouldn't put up with it if you had the choice.
Which is forbearance.
Forbearance, it's also
sure
used. Yeah.
Again,
that's in a similar meaning. I mean, in that context, it means, for example, it's used in a case of when you're sitting in meditation and the ants are crawling all over you. You know, you're forbearing. Yeah, you're patient with that. But again, you could still use acceptance with that as well. Yeah, you're just accepting the situation. Yeah. So you can find that comes in. Sorry. Sorry.
I was just trying to understand the word. I said there's a lot of different directions going.
Yeah. And in Sri Lankan, it means bride. Yeah. It means bride, can't you? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, doesn't it? That's what I was told.
What's the word for bride then?
Because we've got a good friend called Kanti, and that's what I think she told me, that the word means bride in Sinhala. Yeah.
No, I haven't heard
that. She has to be patient, yeah. and accepting and forbearing. Yeah.
Acceptance of views by pondering,
Because it's a compound, the relationship between the elements of the compound is not spelt out. Okay? So one of the things is that in one of the more difficult aspects of Pali grammar is that there are various kinds of ways that you can construe the relationship between different elements in a compound. Often, of course, most of the time it's intuitive and you just recognize it just by seeing it, but sometimes it can be construed in slightly different ways, as in this case, and sometimes it's possible to go through a long and complicated grammatical analysis to at least exclude certain interpretations, although you might not be able to define the exact one. But I think Bhikkhu Bodhi here is quite right, the acceptance of a view after pondering it. Okay, the next one.
Kheti.
Kheti.
Anger.
Anger. Well, that could also apply, yeah. It might be even a dialect word or something. Okay, so now Bhahma Bhab Rupataya, it's another interesting little word. Taneshiro has probability. Okay. And Bhikkhu Bodhi has by the seeming competence of a speaker.
That's pretty good. Very good.
All right. Interesting, isn't it? So the analysis of the word here, this ending is just the grammatical ending. Okay, so you can ignore that little bit. The two words that have meaning here, bhabba, I'll just say it once more, because that's a nice word. Bhabba. Meaning means possible. Okay, possible. Rupa here means something like seeming or appearing, okay, or form. Okay, so bhava rupa. So here you can see where Taneshiro has come off that, like possible. It's possible seeming. Yeah, it seems as if it's possible. Right, therefore it's probable or not probable. Yeah, So this is where Taneshiro has got that interpretation from, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's got his interpretation by interpreting it as applying to a person. So a person who seems or appears, Bhabha is probable, or competent, in he's translated in that context.
Bhabha meaning
is just the grammatical ending. So Bhabha in the sense of can do, yeah? So Bhabha means something is possible, you can do something. So Bhabha Rupa meaning he's a can do kind of guy. Right? Yeah.
Where is speaking?
That he's just put that in there to make up his word count. Yeah.
So in the context of Bhabha Rupa.
Yeah, that's how Bhikkhu Bodhi's interpreted it.
How would you?
Why is it only probable, like, when it's dead?
Sorry?
Why isn't it translated like that it's only probable? What he said is not the competence of the sayer.
Yeah.
But just what he said.
Well, that's I think Taneshiro's thing. Yeah, it's focused on the word and Bhabha Rupataya. Possible that Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't have a note there. It's possible that might be in accordance with the commentarial. No. No, it's just an abstract noun form, so it just means ness. Yeah, by competent seemingness. But again, I mean, in this, I know that Bhikkhu Bodhi's relying on the work of Jayati Lekha, and he's looked into that in quite some detail, so. You know, I'd have a sort of prima facie trust that he's probably got it right in that case.
That's all these things relate to what at the time what they accept for who says and what.
Yeah.
If it is now, they will say even better.
They say the same thing. It's a Bhabha Rupataya, you know. Well, I listened to him, it was very, very persuasive.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it came across well, and seemed good, seemed to know what he's talking about. Yeah.
It covers everyone who you believe in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a different kind of.
And just to cover everything.
Everything, yeah.
At the time.
Yep. And the last one, the thought, Samano no Garu. Okay. And samana means the ascetic, Taneshiro has the contemplative, no means our, garu is guru, yeah? So basically means is respected, okay, our respected one. So we believe it because it's our teacher. Bhikkhu Bodhi has the ascetic is our teacher. And Taneshiro has this contemplative is our teacher, so it's very similar. Okay, so just believing something because your teacher says that it's so. So just to come back to these and go through them again, just to remind, so not by hearing from another, not by lineage or tradition, not by legends, not by inclusion in the canon, not by logic, not by inference, not by reflection on reasons, or reasoned reflection, something like that. Not by acceptance of a view after pondering it. Not by seeming competence. And not by thinking the ascetic is our teacher or is our guru.
Could you translate the competence one as, or another way of putting it would be, charismatic?
Exactly. That's exactly what it's pointing towards. Yeah, a charismatic teacher. Yeah.
In other words, it covers the 500s in a way.
In what way?
Everything that comes from 500s is
I don't know. Maybe. Well, I don't know about that, because it's not talking about, I mean, the point of it is it's not, what it's not talking about is direct experience.
Yeah.
So you have direct experience of the khandhas. So it's talking...
The first one is...
Yeah.
Would that be cause of fun? And then your mind?
Maybe. Yeah, I'm just a bit cautious because I wouldn't use the categories or the teachings of the khandhas in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that that's wrong, but just to say that I'm not quite sure that that's the point that's being made here.
Mm-hmm.
The point that's being made here is more about the conventional ways that people come to accept truths within a society.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and obviously is still the way that we do that today. Yeah? We still come to truth by similar kinds of things, and these ideas, you know, because it's traditional, it's just being passed down, we've always believed that. And a lot of people still believe things because it's itikira. Thus it seems, you know, people say it must be so because it's in Genesis or something like that. It's included in the Bible or included in the Quran or included in the Dhammapada, therefore it must be true. By logic, and we were talking with Kim earlier today about how in quantum mechanics you have this kind of this tiny little few kind of experimental results, and just on the basis of a few results you then develop this whole chain of mathematical reasoning, and then at the end of it you say this is what the nature of the world is, and you've actually got all of these steps of inference. Sorry?
First, you have to be mathematics, then you have
to be yeah.
Not even that.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, there's two different attitudes towards logic. I mean, the Socratic attitude towards the. Sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, well, it's good that the sun's gone down. I don't need it. I think it's fine, yeah. It's okay? You can leave that open, Kim. Yeah, a bit of... Yeah, maybe that's... Thanks. What's that? Logic. Yeah, too. Basically, like Socratic attitude towards logic is that by use of logic itself, because logic is kind of perfect, then you can arrive at the perfect absolute truth by means of logic. And so that's always his way. Another sort of a more reasonable or more common use of logic today is that it's used in the sense of to point in or to lead out to certain directions which can then be tested. Yeah. So that's more an empirical approach to logic, is that logic by itself isn't going to find you the answer, but it can lead you in a certain direction which will open up certain questions which you can then test empirically. And the Buddha heard things from others, and the Buddha, you know, set up a tradition, and he had a pitika and all of these things. So he's not saying don't have these things. Okay, we'll have a look more in a more nuanced way at what he's saying later on. Okay. But essentially the point is that none of these is like a final arrival at truth, and that's more explicitly taught in some of the later suttas. Yeah. So, I mean, particularly the Bhava Rupata is very important today. You know, you have to have your PhD and, you know, all of these things, and people will really take you seriously if you kind of, you know, if you go to, it's always interesting, like if you go to the doctors or something like that, they have this whole kind of thing with the way that they dress and the way that they organise their office and everything, that create this impression of competence, which is half of the curing. And then they prescribe you something, actually it's a placebo, but they've sort of done this whole thing of creating that, and that's you're willing to accept it. All right? So, then what he says. Okay, when you know for yourselves. These things are unwholesome, these things are blameable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. Okay, so it's encouraging them to know for themselves. And these terms are akusala, kusala, unskillful, always defined as leading to suffering. That's akusala, leads to suffering. These dhammas are savajja, blameworthy. And these dhammas are vinyugarahita, criticized by the wise. And these dhammas, when undertaken and practiced, lead to suffering, dukkha. When you know that, yeah, for yourself, then you should abandon them.
But to know that to yourself, you need to have really good education and different reasoning.
If those things help, then yeah.
Yeah.
But also you know them through your experience.
Hmm.
Yeah? So for example, you go out and get drunk in the night, in the morning you wake up and you've got a hangover and you know, oh well, that act led to this suffering. Yeah, you don't know about it because of reason cogitation.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, you can't make any reason cogitation. In a sense, yes. Yeah.
It's a process of, you know, understanding.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other than
what kind of stuff. I mean,
there is a direct knowledge or intuition.
Yeah.
Still,
you know,
major part of doing it, and that's how you learn
how to mess
them
up. It is, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So, let's just bear that in mind and continue. So, remember that it is nuanced. It's not saying get rid of these things entirely.
Mm,
yeah.
But don't just get obsessed to this.
We'll see more clearly later on. It addresses that specific point in one of the later suttas, yeah? So, okay, and what do you think? When greed arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? Okay, when lobha, for the harm. And this greedy person, overcome by greed, kills living beings, takes what is not given, goes after another person's wife, tells, what did she say? Paradharampi gacchati. Yeah, it's a literal translation there. Paradharampi gacchati. Tells lies, induces others to do otherwise, all of which is for their long-term harm and suffering. Yes, Bhante, what do you think? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Yeah. Okay. Are these unwholesome? Are they blameable or blameless? Blameable, censured or praised by the wise, censured by the wise, undertaken and practiced, do they lead to harm or and suffering or not? Or how is it in this case? Undertaken and practiced, these things lead to harm and suffering. So it appears to us in this case. Okay? So he's giving that standard and then asking them about it. Seems to be, Chanasura seems to be working from a different... when we translate it differently, you're working from a different reading. Mm.
Interesting from the time.
Yeah, they seem to have done the repetitions differently. Okay. He is condensing all that. He's got more here than Tanisra. It just seems to be organized differently, yeah. And then the same thing for anger, and the same thing for delusion, and of course the reverse for non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion, that all of those things lead to pleasure and so on. Okay. So... then it has an interesting passage at the end. Okay. So then, now this is very curious. Tanisra's translation here is very curious. It finishes off, so then when you know these things are wholesome, these things are unwholesome, you will abandon the unwholesome, and the wholesome ones you will enter upon and abide in them. Okay? And this is what was said. So then it goes on to the next paragraph, and so Kalamas, that Arya Savaka, that noble disciple, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates, it's always translated as noble disciple. However, Dhanisara has that one who is a disciple of the noble ones. Very curious translation, but no idea why he's done that. Anyway, a noble disciple, thus devoid of greed, vigata bija, greed of devoid of ill will, devoid of confusion, clearly comprehending, mindful. Okay, so it's a bit of an abrupt shift here in the topic, and he's gone from discussion of like listening to different teachers and discerning whether one teacher is right or not, and we've now abruptly moved into a noble disciple and quite an advanced stage of meditation, which we're going on to in a minute. It's a bit abrupt, although this is perhaps one link, because he's been talking about greed, hatred and delusion, then it says free of covetousness, aversion and confusion, so it's there's certainly a link there. And then has the standard passage on development of the Brahma Viharas. Ever mindful dwells, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second quarter, the third, and the fourth, thus above, below, across, and everywhere to all as to himself. He dwells, pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, and without ill will. So this is actually a very beautiful chant, this particular passage. We used to do it quite a lot at Manachat. It's got a nice kind of rhythm to it. Just as a kind of by-the-by point, just following on from the research I did in history of mindfulness, of course you so often find in contemporary meditation movements this idea that mindfulness is vipassana, and this kind of contrast between mindfulness and vipassana on one hand and samadhi and samatha on the other hand. But here in this passage we're obviously talking about jhana based on metta, what's conventionally regarded as a samatha practice, but here it mentions one's mindful. No mention of practicing samadhi here, but only mention of mindfulness and clear comprehension. So it's just to show that these qualities are not, you know, mindfulness is not the quality you practice when you're doing vipassana, and it's not relevant in samatha practice. It's equally relevant in both practices. Okay. Undeluded. Where are we going? Devoid of your will. Undeluded. Yeah. Alert, sampajana, yeah, it's a bit weird for sampajana, and resolute, yeah, you're right. Patisata, yeah, why he's got resolute there, I've got no idea. Maybe another reading in the Thai version. But maybe more likely just one of Tanisro's somewhat eccentric renderings. And this particular phrase is also an interesting phrase. Sabbatataya, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as to all as to himself. Tanisara has translated it as everywhere and in every respect, which is not. It's a bit. It's a bit. There are different readings of that, but this one, Bhikkhu Bodhi's reading, is the most obvious one. Sabbatata. So all selfness. Okay? So translated as to all, to each as to oneself. Or to all as to oneself. Okay. Okay. Vipulena, Mahagatena, Apamanena. And of course these words, you know, vipulena is vast, and mahagatena is like become great, like blown up into greatness. Apamanena is measureless. So all of these ideas, you know, so sometimes we have this, we're given this impression that, that samadhi practice is about kind of very narrow focus on something, but it's obviously not what the suttas are getting at here. So this is a standard description of the jhana based on metta, and then we have also karuna, mudita, and upekha, sahagatena. Okay. So it's not quite sure why it's moved on now to the noble disciple. Normally, noble disciple of course means a stream enterer and so on. There's nothing particularly about that passage before that implies that somebody's become a stream enterer. Like normally they say you realize the Four Noble Truths, or you see, you know, the nature of arising and passing away or something like that. It doesn't really say that, it just introduces it, but that's the mention of the Arya Savaka in this kind of context is also fairly conventional, so it could easily just crept into the text as part of a stock passage, so wouldn't necessarily want to make too much of that mention in this particular context there. Okay, and then Kailamas, when that noble disciple is therefore, his mind is free of aversion, free of anger, free of defilement, and purified. Okay, so it's interesting, it's similar to the description we had before, without, you know, covetousness, without ill will and so on, but now it's more, even more intensified, without defilement and purified. He has won four assurances in this very life. If there is paro loko, if there is another world, and remember I mentioned before that we had the parampara, the lineage, param, 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 beyond, 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 on and on and on. It's the same word here. There's another world. There's a world beyond. If there is a world beyond, and there is a the result of sukata dukkata nankamana, of well done and badly done deeds. So sukata, so to break this up, sukata, well done, dukkata, okay, dukkata, deeds, okay, kammanang palang vipako, there is, of good and bad deeds, there is the fruit and result of, there is the fruit and result. So just as a grammatical point, anyone who's studying Pali, if you see in these compound, there's a difference, there's an asymmetry between sukata and dukkata, yeah, so sukata is 1k, dukkata is 2k's, and dukkata also has a retroflex t here. The reason for that is because the prefix su, in Sanskrit we spell su, yeah? But the prefix du in Sanskrit is dus. Okay, so the s disappears in here and becomes the second k, or dus, or sometimes, I think maybe even dur. The same word as the dukkata offence. Yeah, this is like a natural language version of the word that became a technical veneer term. Yeah, and the lost consonant here, the lost s, is also felt as the retroflex. Is it, it's not an s. It may be a r actually. I think there might be some ambiguity in that.
Isn't Sanskrit much later than Pali?
Yeah, but that's true. The formalized Sanskrit, but the Pali forms are still derived from Vedic.
Vedic roots.
Yeah, Vedic roots, where these things are often the same, yeah.
The Vedic roots are more spelled out in the Sanskrit. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. The Sanskrit is like a more is a spelled out, explicit and consistent rendering of that Vedic system. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In certain circumstances.
In certain circumstances, yeah. Thank you for that. So that's why there's the difference in the spelling. There, between the dukkata and sukata.
So it's one of them.
Yep, well done and bad done. Deeds that are well done and bad done. Okay. Kamas. There is, after the breakup of the body, kaisabheda, paramaran, after death, and then after with the breakup of the body, after death, I will reappear, upapajisami, in a good destiny, in a heavenly world. Okay? This is the first reassurance that one gains. Okay? So it's a hypothetical very kind of rational process, isn't it? Yeah? Okay, so this is, if this is the case, then that will follow. So here he's using the inference, which he was told not to use in the first part. Alright. But it's not. This is not like a dogmatic insistence on that particular belief. It's a conditional one, saying if this is the case, then that's arising. And it's very important to notice this, because often it's said all these kind of cliches that in the Buddha's time, sort of like everyone believed in karma and rebirth, and so the Buddha was just following along with the teaching at his time and blah blah blah. When he's teaching, well, quite obviously not. I mean, even here he's speaking to a bunch of lay people, and even among them, he's not assuming that they believe in karma and rebirth. Yeah, quite on the contrary, he's assuming that they are uncertain about it and actually discussing it and may or may not believe in it. And so he's showing them how they can work within that uncertainty. Yeah, and so this has got nothing to do with what the Buddha himself is saying is true or not true. It's about how he's saying that they, with their doubts, can still find a proper way to act. Yeah.
This is also like the start of the gradual training. There's a lot talk of heavens and the benefits of dana, generosity.
Yep.
Talk of heavens and hell.
I mean, one of the interesting things here is that because it mentions the Aryasavaka, so this is a bit controversial, because normally it would be understood that the noble disciple, somebody who's a stream mentor or someone, would have an acceptance of those ideas of heaven and hell and rebirth and things like that. Whereas here they still seem to be playing their cards both ways. I mean, the passage itself is not saying whether he believes in it or not. It's simply saying that kind of a thought process. But as I said before, that the use of the term Aryasavaka is so common and so conventional that it would be unwise to insist too much on a particular interpretation based on that in this particular passage.
Maybe that's why Tengasura translates it differently. Maybe
could be,
of an Arya.
Exactly, yeah. He's trying to get away from that, yeah.
That's not mentioned, but the three aspects for one who's a stream mentor winner. There's only three aspects. It doesn't mention anything about belief in heavens and hells or other worlds.
No, because he's got right view.
But he would that would only reply to oneself.
No, because Lokiya right view, worldly right view, is defined as believing in karma and rebirth, basically.
There is mother, there is father. There is
spontaneously revealed beings, and there's this world and the other world, and these kinds of things. Mahatmatarisaka Sutta. Yeah.
So I wonder, what was the reason that Buddha was saying that if there is not another world?
Yeah.
And if there is another world.
So the premise of the sutta is he's talking to these kalamas who have a lot of doubts about what is the case, and he's saying to them, well, you can't rely on all of these reasons to find those things out, and so nevertheless, if you purify your own mind, then you have this reassurance. If it's the case, then I get to go to heaven. Woo wee. Right? Next one. If there's no other world, no fruit and result of good and bad karma, well, at least I'm happy here. Okay, then. Then here in the present life, I look after myself with ease. And if I was well, then still right here in this happy life, I live happily in this very life. I live happily, free of enmity and ill will. Okay, sukhim atanam pariharami. Okay. I carry myself with happiness. Okay? And notice the use of the word vitteva dhamme. They often translate as here and now, but literally it means, ditta. Ditta is visible or seen. Dhamma means dhamma, in the dhamma. Vitteva means very, exactly, precisely, this. It's an idiom, it means in this very life. So it's here, it's contrasting with the life beyond, yeah? So just to note that, and it's a synonym with the words sandhyatika, and also probably with akalika. Okay, so if third assurance here is one is this. suppose evil befalls the evil doer, then as I do not intend evil for anyone, how can suffering afflict me, one who does no evil deed? Right. Okay. And the fourth assurance is, suppose evil does not befall the evil doer, then right here I see myself purified in both respects. Okay, so I see myself ubhayeneva visudhang, and Bodhi's got a footnote on that, the both respects bit. And then chapter 3. Okay, and the commentary on that particular, the idea of the both respects means because he does no evil and because no evil or suffering will come to him. Okay, and I think we've discussed this before, but this word papa doesn't really mean evil. It's not as intense as the word evil. It's more just bad or wicked or something like that. Wrong. I do no wrong. Sometimes means naughty, yeah. Papi dasi.
The naughty man.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So both respects, because he's happy because both he does no good and because he does no bad and no bad comes to him. Yeah. Okay. And then the Kalamas rejoiced in that and agreed with the Buddha and then went to the Blessed One for refuges. Okay.
So this sutta, how is it misquoted in modern/postmodern times?
Well, it's often quoted as saying, "Don't rely on faith, rely on reason." Okay.
Yep.
And obviously, that's not what it's saying. Yep. Yeah, it's saying both faith and reason can be unreliable.
So how is this line of
okay. Let's have a look at the next couple of suttas and let's see if they answer that closed question.
The funny thing is, when they use a quote, they don't quote the rest of it.
That's right, yeah.
And then they don't quote the part about ego because
yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, it sounds like the commentary background, which is pretty much a sort of an expansion on the thing. It sounds pretty reasonable. Yeah. Okay, so here we have the Gamani Samyutta, or Gamani Vagga in Gamani Samyutta, the Samyutta on the headmen. And this particular one has two Chinese corresponding suttas, one in the Chinese Sanyukta Agama belonging to the thanks, Carly. And also in SA 2, which of course as we know SA 2 as we know
is there's three sanyuktas.
That's the second one. Yeah.
Yeah,
thanks. And belonging to
which school?
SA 2 is the partial Sanyutta, Kaisho 100, and currently being translated and worked on by Marcus Bingenheimer at Dhammadrom, and is of an unknown school affiliation.
That's why I didn't interrupt.
Okay. Now, the best one was saying among the Malas, because the Malas being the one of the tribes who was included in the Vajjian Confederation, and they, of course, near the Mala town where the Buddha passed away. Okay, so we're going to have to rip through these a bit quicker. Bhadraka, the headman, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down on the side, and said to him, "It would be good if the Blessed One would teach me about the origin and the passing away of suffering." This is an interesting one. Because normally the Buddha kind of puts people off if they ask silly questions, and he actually wants them to ask about the origin and passing away of suffering, yeah? But here he asks a very direct question, so you'd think he'd say, okay, I'll just give him the Four Noble Truths, but he actually gives quite an oblique answer. "If, headman, I were to teach you about the origin and passing away of suffering of Tanisha has stress, of course, with reference to the past, saying so it was in the past, perplexity, uncertainty about that might arise in you. If I were to teach you about the origin and passing away of suffering with reference to the future, saying so it will be in the future, perplexity, uncertainty about that might arise in you. Instead, headman, while I'm sitting right here and you are sitting right there, I will teach you about the origin and passing away of suffering. Listen and attend closely." Okay? Yes, Venerable Sir. And the Blessed One said this. "Are there in this Uruvela Kappa any people on whose account sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection and despair would arise in you if they were to be executed, imprisoned, fined or censured?" Yeah? He says there are such people. "But are there people in the Uruvela Kappa on whose account depression and anxiety would not arise if they were to be killed or imprisoned?" "There are such people. Why is it, sir, that in some cases you'd be depressed and in other cases you would not?" And he says that in the case of the people who depression would arise, then that is because those are the people I feel desire and passion, Tanisara translates. Bhikkhu Bodhi has, "I fear, have desire and attachment." Let's see what the Pali is there. Chandarago. Yeah. Okay, desire and passion or attachment, or anyway, idea is pretty clear. Okay. So, by means of this principle, headman, that is seen, understood, immediately attained, fathomed, apply the method to the past and to the future. Thus, whatever suffering arose in the past, all that arose rooted in desire, with desire as its source, for desire is the root of suffering. Whatever suffering will arise in the future, all that will arise rooted in desire, with desire as its source, for desire is the root of suffering. Okay, so this is very interesting. He said he was not... why he's gone this particular path is a bit obscure. Maybe it had to do with the particular character of Bhadraka. Yeah? So maybe he knew something about his character and his tendencies. That's why he's chosen this slightly unusual way to present it. But the interesting point here is that in talking about it, first of all, he says, okay, I'm going to address suffering here and now. So he's not... in this case, he's not pointing him to a question of say direct personal experience of what's, you know, they say mind body phenomena in the present moment, right? That's not what he's doing. He's asking about people who are alive and on whose account he would feel anxiety and depression. Yeah? So it's important to notice this, the way we talk about present moment, he's talking in the present moment. Are there people alive now whose death would cause you suffering? That present moment is not the same present moment as the kind of the moment-to-moment mindfulness present moment that we're taught in maybe in a Vipassana retreat or something like that. Okay, it's a different way of relating to the present moment. Okay, so that's important to notice that. And then he says, by this Dhamma, He doesn't use translate Dhamma in here. By this Dhamma, here Bhikkhu Bodhi translates Dhamma as principle. And again, I had some conversation with Bhikkhu Bodhi about this rendering when he was translating his Samyutta. And I was following, I believe, Warder, if I remember rightly, argued that the primary and the most common meaning of Dhamma is principle. And I was trying to persuade Bhikkhu Bodhi that the word principle could be used to render Dhamma in many contexts, not necessarily all of them, but in many. But he did use it in this particular context by means of this principle that is seen, dhyata, understood, vidita, that is timeless, akalika. So remember previously we were talking about that phrase dhyateva dhamme in this very moment or in this very life, yeah? And so this is similar kinds of phrases, that dhamma which is dhyata and akalika, yeah? Timeless. So this is a phrase we chant in the chant recollection of the dhamma, akaliko, sandhittiko akaliko. So this is the meaning of akalika in this kind of context. It's what you're seeing, that result you're seeing applying in this very life. Patena, pariyogalhena. Okay, so this is a kind of slightly unusual idiom. Patta means attained right now in the present, something like that. Patta, attained, usually reached. Okay, immediately attained, fathomed. Okay, then atita nagate. You should lead, or you should infer an inference regarding the past and the future. It's a literal translation. You should infer an inference regarding the past and the future. So here the same word naya that was said don't rely on naya hetu in the previous one, we're now being taught how to apply a naya hetu, okay? How to apply a naya, an inference. What? Sorry?
I thought that was kind of like big, and I think Hassan Tisro makes the point that when, depends how you translate it, not go by this thing,
mm-hmm.
very different from like depending on relying on or not. It was never a complete rejection of go by. So this kind of contrasting.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't make sense to me. That this reading kind of implying that if Kalama Sutta, he was saying, don't make sense, which is never.
Yeah, I mean the Kalama Sutra literally it says ma XYZ I ma not by such and such. Yeah? Is the literal translation is not by such and such, not by such and such, not by such and such, but by knowing and seeing for yourself. Yeah. Again we'll come back, we'll resolve that further when we have a look at some of the later suttas, especially the Chanki Sutta makes that very clear, okay?
That seems visible contained in this one though, because he establishes that the truth of the immediacy of suffering
first.
And now he's going on to the inference.
Yeah. Yep.
That you should now look at that truth of your suffering here and now if your friends passed away,
yeah.
That would cause you suffering.
Yeah.
Now think of the inference, the connections between those.
Yeah. And it certainly could relate to that thing I mentioned before about the Socratic method, where you actually just base everything on a priori reason. Yeah? So you just say, you can just reason things out from first principles. So here he's not reasoning from first principles, he's reasoning from experience, and then inferring that. Yeah?
Because the Buddha says you can't reason something like hammering it out,
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. That's again the word tucker is there. Yeah, it's somebody who, that's one class of ascetics or summoners, is one who just hammer everything out by reason. So again, that's very much the Socratic idea, is you just follow that chain of logic through. Yeah, and of course the problem is that you can drift very far from the real world. So this is the difference, isn't it? And in Jayatilaka, I mentioned Jayatilaka is early Buddhist theory of knowledge. I mean, essentially what he argues is that the Buddha was an empiricist. And he was followed by Kalapahana in that. And the idea, the basic difference is that in an empirical philosophy, you stay close to the data, you stay close to the evidence, and you can reason to a certain degree, you can infer to a certain degree from that evidence, but you still keep on referring back to it, and you don't drift too far away from the actual evidence. Whereas in a logical system or a pure rational system, you reason, the logic actually supersedes the evidence. So if the evidence disagrees with your theory, then there's something wrong with the evidence. Yeah? So and quite literally, so this is how the logical philosophers say Socrates and Plato would distrust the senses, because you can be misled by your senses, but you can't be misled by reason. Okay. So for example, you know, you can see a shape, and you can ask, is that shape a circle or not? Yeah. And if you just go from your eyes, well, maybe you're seeing at an angle or something like that, and so you can be mistaken about whether it's a circle or not. But when you reason it out logically, you can be sure that it's a perfect geometrical circle.
But all reason is based on sense experience.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and that's one of the great fallacies of the Socratic thing, is to think that you can actually have that reasoning from first principles. Yeah, that was wasn't it Kant, that critique of pure reason?
Kant tried to dissolve the man of God.
Yeah.
He didn't have the capacity to rationalist and the empiricist.
Yeah.
Then she divided down the center.
Yeah.
And he tried to do it. Tried to take a test at a kind of,
yeah,
try to resolve the man.
Similar debate. And then, but you have, but you do have a. Well, it's kind of been debated, and it has always been debated. But the general tendency in the West has to move from that kind of rationalist thing to more of an empirical. And these days you have the triumph of science, so it's. Empiricism has become much more. Yeah?
First principles.
Yeah?
I don't know what it's like to be very mathematical.
Yeah.
To be based on their assumptions or their constellations that you have.
So yeah.
You have to have them.
Yeah, you have to have
them. You're not saying that there's nothing. But there has to be something there behind them.
Yeah, an example. Yeah, that's true. An example of that in mathematics, say, is Euclid. And so Euclid says that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, yeah, and that's a first principle. So that's an assumption which you bring to it, an assumption which obviously is very useful for doing all kinds of things. And it's not until more than 2,000 years later that Einstein comes along and says, well, no, actually, because of the effects of gravity in space, then the shortest distance between two points is actually a curve.
That's the problem of context, say, in algebra.
Yeah. Sure.
So the first axiom in algebra.
Right. So that's based on an idea of what one is. Yeah, yeah. So it's a sensory
experience. But then you can
read
anything
after that in algebra from
those axioms.
Right. And as long as it remains within its own system,
yes,
then it's okay. And when you try to apply it to the real world,
yeah, like
then
you
can
read
about
it.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. But that just shows that Euclid practically works, just like Newton practically works, but it does not necessarily the last word in the matter, yeah.
Okay, and in this example, it's still reasoning, there's no experiential thing, he's not talking about the time that his wife was murdered.
Sure, yeah.
It's still a reasoning.
It is, yeah.
I mean, he might not have.
There is a bit of a gap there, that's true, but it's also quite reasonable to think, well, it's actually based on experience. I mean, most of us have had that kind of experience.
Inference is based on experience.
Yeah. But it's still true, it's all based on an inference, because then that's based on a memory, a projection into the future, all of those kinds of things, yeah, so it's not completely separated from that. Yeah. So, and I think that's important. So, I'm just a bit conscious of the time. So, that all of those points about that are very useful, and that, again, they'll be resolved more when we look at the Chanki Sutta. But just the interesting point here to now, just to, that I'd like to. Chanki Sutta. No relation to Chanki Kasta. Okay. The main thing that I'm interested in here is this relationship between present experience and then referring to the past and the future. Yeah? And that's also mentioned in a number of other suttas, and it's here quite clearly. So it's important to notice that, again, you do find a tendency of what you could call the narcissism of the present moment in Buddhism, where everything's present moment, present moment, present moment, and never think about the past and the future. Yeah, that's not what the Buddha was saying. He's saying, well, let's establish. And here, what he's saying is, let's establish what we can as best as we can here in the present moment. And then from that basis we can infer to the past and the future. Okay?
And he had something to do with, because he triggers your own perplexion and confusion, that's why we need.
Yeah, that's right. It's to address the perplexion. And that's another very important point, because the there's two notions here, and this is what some of the tension is about, I mean, discussing this, is the notion of, is this a search for absolute truth? Okay? Or is it a solution to the problem of addressing the perplexity of people? Yeah? And so if the method is sufficient to actually remove that doubt and to address that doubt, enable people to live well and be happy, then maybe that's enough. Yeah? So maybe that's just another interesting thing, is the effectiveness of it. Okay?
But his first question was about suffering, was it not?
It was suffering. About suffering, yeah.
So that gives the context for this whole extrapolation.
So then it goes on a bit further. I won't go into the rest of that. And the next sutta is the Vimang Saka Sutta. Majima, I'm on page 93, Majima 47. Okay, so Vimangsika Sutta, which has one parallel sutta in the Madhyama Agama of the Savasivadana school. Thank you very much. Maybe I didn't open up the Vimangsika. I thought I didn't open it right now. That's why it's no English translation. So there's no online English translation or nothing on sort of central, that is. What's this one? Spanish. Yeah, it's good.
Spanish.
Only the German one. So, any German speaker?
Yeah. Okay.
Catherine, you will be our guide, our resort. just, I will not read it out. I'm tempted, but okie dokie. That's what I heard. Buddha addressing the monks, he said, monks, a monk who is an inquirer. Okay? By a monk. Inquiry. Yeah, vimangsa, inquiry. Who does not know how to read another person's mind or to gauge another person's mind here. Okay? Okay, so he's talking here's what to do. You haven't developed, you can't read minds, right? So this, how do you find out about your teacher? This is how you should investigate samanesana, whether the Buddha is some Buddha or not. Okay, vinyanaya, for understanding, for vinyana, here meaning understanding. Okay? So This is an interesting opening, yeah? The Buddha saying, well, this is how you test me, this is how you see whether the teacher's a real teacher or not. Okay, blah, blah, blah. So, first one. should investigate the Tathagata with respect to two kinds of dhammas. Whether states dhammas cognizable through the eye and through the ear. Okay, now again, notice this empirical approach of remaining close to the data, close to the experience. Okay, so you're investigating regarding, you have things, you don't know the Tathagata. That's just an idea you have. What you actually know is things that you see and things that you hear. You see him do certain things, you hear him do certain things. So you're staying always close to those things. Are there found in the Tathagata any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? Okay. So here I'm referring to, if you see any defiled behaviors or defiled speech or something like that, then you know that. Are there any mixed states? Okay, if you don't find any defiled states, so for example, you don't see him going out and murdering somebody or something like that. Okay, you know that one. Are there any mixed states? Vidimissa. The word missa is mix. I think it's probably a cognate. Then you should investigate that. Okay, so he does anything from mixed motives. Are there cleansed states cognizable? Okay, vodata. Okay, so can you see cleansed dhammas through the eye and through the ear? Okay, so can you hear him speaking in a way that's pure or acting in a way that's pure? When he comes to know this, he investigates him further thus. Has this venerable one attained this wholesome state over a long time, or did he attain it recently? Digaratam. Udahu ittara samapanno. Okay, a long time or just a short time? And obviously this is a very useful point. It's easy enough to put on a show just for a short amount of time, but hard to sustain it over many years. When he investigates him further, says this venerable one acquired renown and fame so that the dangers connected with renown and fame are found in him. For as long as a monk has not acquired renown and fame, those dangers don't appear, but when he does acquire renown and fame, those dangers are found. Okay, so we, I'm sure, all know some of the dangers of renown and fame. Yeah? You can get very conceited, you get very attached to your ideas, or you're very attached to your position. You can get attached to the people's wealth and all these kinds of things, all these unwholesome dhammas. Okay? I don't know about saying that. I think if you found a spiritual teacher actually editing their own Wikipedia site, then yeah, that might be a little bit of a sign there, yeah.
Entry on the list,
yeah, and
then you go there and say,
and just cleaned it up a bit.
Yeah.
But
what about re-correcting misinformation?
If it's correcting mistakes, that's probably different. Yeah.
Saying that you're
parallel
to Led Zeppelin rather than
I'll probably leave that on. Okay. Okie dokie. Next one. Is this first venerable one restrained without fear, not restrained by fear? And does he avoid indulging in potential pleasures because he was out lust through the destruction of lust? Okay. So this is also, this is getting a bit more subtle, isn't it? Yeah. Why are they actually behaving in that way? You know, are they like you can have a behavior because you're making yourself do that behavior because you think it's the right kind of thing, or is it just because it's actually naturally how you are?
That's what Ajahn Brahm talks about. Actually, he talks about how there's some monks that you absolutely perfect and you can even think that they're an arhat, but actually that is not necessarily the case. That a lot of that actually comes from control. That they control themselves to be in that way, but really underneath it's not really the case at all.
Yep.
That they're enlightened.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just put that question to Kalyana. And he said, that's the starting point, so you can control your action. It's the starting point.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. So again, it's not saying you shouldn't control it, but it's just saying if it's coming from that, then that's a sign that you're not really complete in your spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You think that that control should change into a natural habit pattern or a natural part of your arena and personality?
Yeah, sure.
Instead of it being something which you're kind of forcing upon yourself.
Of course. Yeah.
And that over a period of time, then that becomes a natural quality of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a natural quality, not simply because it's habituation, but because you understand that it's good.
Yeah, you understand that it's good to see the answer to something.
Okay. Now, if anybody should ask that bhikkhu, what are that person's reasons? Okay, so here we have akara, word I mentioned before, akara parigitaka. So here's one place where it does obviously mean reason. What are the akara? What is the anvaya? And here also meaning inference. Okay, so the word here is anu, aya, follow along, go along with, meaning inference. What is the evidence that you say that Venerable One is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, he avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he was without lust through the destruction of lust? Answering rightly, that monk would answer thus. Whether that Venerable One dwells in the Sangha or alone, whether there are some well-behaved and some where... While some there are well-behaved, and some are ill-behaved, and some there teach a group, and some are concerned about material things, and some are unsullied about material things, still that Venerable One does not despise anyone because of that. Okay? So this is watching his behaviour with different people. So you're not favouring and opposing, you're living with a large group of people, some well-behaved, some good monks, bad monks, whatever, and then you're not going around favouring, opposing, and so on because of that. So you have that equanimity with people. So this is one way of seeing how is a person coping within that sometimes stressful or difficult situation. So that's one criteria. Second criteria it mentions, and I've heard and learnt this from the Blessed One's own lips, I am restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and I avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because I'm without lust through the destruction of lust. Okay, so, and again, it's his personal testimony of the Buddha, right? But that is not just his personal testimony, right? That's one of the criteria. What do they actually say about themselves? Yeah, but not just taking that alone. Then you should further question the Tathagata. Tathagata va uttaring patipuccita bo. You should further question the Tathagata. Are those defiled states cognizable through the eye of the ear found in you? He says, no, they're not. So asking again about all of these things, the mixed states, the cleansed states, are they found within you? He says, no. So here the Buddha is giving his own testimony that what seems the case is in fact the case according to his testimony. And notice the word of vyakareya is the answer. That's the vyakarana. Vyakara, and this is according to the gist I wrote, the first part of History of Mindfulness, this is what Vyakarana as an Anga is question and answer sessions.
So B and
B? B is the same, yeah. It's B is just it's kind of the Burmese spelling, yeah. Vya is more Sanskritized. Vya is probably a Pali thing, more colloquial. Okay. So monk should approach a teacher who speaks thus in order to teach to hear the Dhamma. So in other words, a teacher who appears to be appears to be pure and doing the right thing and who's says that they're coming from the right place, and then they should listen to the Dhamma from that person. So this is a further testing means. The teacher teaches them the Dhamma with its successively higher levels, its successively more sublime levels with its dark and bright counterparts. As the teacher teaches the Dhamma to a monk in this way through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in this Dhamma, Ere kachang dhammang dhammesu, he comes to a conclusion about the teachings, Nyetthang Gacchati. We'll look at this phrase more in the next sutta. And comes to faith or clarity about the teacher, regarding the teacher. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the right way. And if people ask him about that, they say, what is your reason why you say that? And you say, because of your practicing. Okay, so here's the further stage. You've looked, you've seen, the Buddha seems to be a good teacher. He seems to be acting kindly, not cruelly. He seems to be speaking kindly and not cruelly. His own testimony is that he's speaking from a place of purity. So I should have an initial faith on that, practice the teachings and see where those teachings lead me. And if those teachings lead to the results that the Buddha was saying, if the teacher says, practice meditation on the breath and that will lead to peace of mind, and you do the meditation on the breath, it leads to peace of mind, then you think, okay, this is a confirmation of the teaching. But in particular, the Nyetthang Gacchati is quite a serious level of confirmation. It's not just an initial thing. All right. When anyone's faith has been planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata through these reasons, terms, and phrases, okay, so these reasons, akara, these terms, these pada, these vyanjana, phrases, then his faith is said to be supported by reasons, rooted in vision, firm. Okay, so sadha, that faith is akaravati, sadha, dasana mulika, okay, rooted in vision, reasoned, again, this idea of the reason, the akara is reasoned, and is firm, dalha. So this phrase, akaravati sadha, was picked up and pointed out by Jayati Leke again, who sort of showed the contrast between this reasoned faith and andhasadha, is blind faith. And so this is actually found quite explicitly within the early texts. Okay, so again, this is not the kind of the simplistic, sometimes the simplistic kind of modernist idea that Buddhism, you don't have faith. Yeah, so it's not saying don't have faith, but it's saying the faith is reasoned, and how what's the right way to have faith, and it's showing you a method of how to do that. Okay.
But just rewinding a bit, that's
just like you know, whether things are good and bad, or lead to good and bad results, and these kinds of things. Yeah.
I probably missed it, but when he's referring to understanding any mixed state,
yeah.
Does that mean defiled and not defiled?
Defiled and undefiled, yeah. So people coming from mixed motives, yeah. And is invincible by any ascetic or Brahman or Deva or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. That is how much there is an investigation of the Tathagata in accordance with the Dhamma, and that is how the Tathagata is well investigated in accordance with the Dhamma. Okay? So this is the Vimamsaka Sutta. So it's quite nice, isn't it? So we move from there. It's nearly 6 o'clock. So this is the one we've been putting off our for. So we want to make sure we get through this. So Chunky Sutta correspondences for the Chunky Sutta. And notice here we have four Sanskrit correspondences. No, this is the blah blah, blah, and no Chinese ones. Okay, and here it gives the details. One in the Jangi Sutra of the Mahasanghika Lokuttaravadins.
It would have been
up in. Okay, yeah. We have some of the stuff in the Shuan collection. Yeah, it may well have that. I think in the one that we have. Yeah, and it would have been Afghanistan or something like that. As I said, the Mahasanghika Lokut, the Bamiyan Buddhas were Mahasanghika Lokuttaravada.
The rabbis.
Yeah, so they were the ones who believed that the Buddha was like really big. So that's why they built the like really big statues. This one is the Dirghagama of the Sarvastivadins, okay, which is a manuscript, Sanskrit manuscript, which Hartmann is still working on. And so that has the sutta as well. More segments, fragments, and then down here is HT from Turkan. So a few different versions, but no translations of this into Chinese. The reason was, well, it's not translated into Chinese because there's no doctrinal reason why. The reason was because the Sarvastivadins put their version of this sutta in their Dirgha Agama. And the Dirgha Agama is not of the Sarvastivadins, wasn't translated into Chinese. They had the Dirgha Agama of the Dharmaguptaka instead. So the Dharmaguptaka presumably had their copy of the Chanki Sutta in the Majjhima, with the same as the Theravadins, and the Sarvastivadins had theirs in the Digha, so we sort of missed out getting that one into the Chinese translation. Sometimes these things are just random. Yeah, it's not published yet, but yeah, it's coming along. Hopefully. Okay. Chanki comes along. At that time, Chanki is a Brahmin. I'll sort of rush through this a little bit. This is an excerpt from Nyanamoli. At that time, there's a Brahmin student called Karpatikar, young, shaven-headed, 16 years old. He was a master of the three Vedas with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology. All right. So this is a standard description of a Brahmin student. Kind of precocious brat. Usually that's the usual kind of assumption that you have there is when you hear this kind of I'm just trying to find where that's in the Pali. They've all abbreviated it. There's a whole long introduction here. This the whole introduction is very very similar to the Digha Nikaya Suttas. Here's a long sort of list of reasons why they should go to see the Buddha. So here's the Kapatiko, the Brahmin student. Himan Vedanam Paragu, so knowledgeable in the three Vedas. And so this is a standard list of the Vedic literature as it was known in the Buddha's time. So the three Vedas. These days we have four Vedas. The other one is the Atharva Veda, which is mentioned a few times but wasn't included in the canonical collections. And with their vocabularies, so Nigandu, something like that. Vocabularies, liturgy, Ketu, Ba. Phonology, Sakara, Akara. And etymology, Pabhedanam. And the histories as a fifth. Okay, so the histories is the fifth section. Itihasa. So remember we had the Itigira before, and I said that the it's probably related to this idea of a legendary history. So I think this is Itihasa and Itigira are related. So this is one of the things interesting about this is it's showing how advanced the linguistic sciences were already in the time of the Buddha. Remembering that by the time of the Buddha, the Vedas were already very ancient knowledge. So for the Brahmins in the Buddha's day, to be reading them would be like for us to be reading a Latin scripture. Okay? Or perhaps not Latin, perhaps Beowulf or something like that. Yeah, Old English. Not Middle English, but Old English. Okay, so it would be literally incomprehensible when you read it, and you'd have to relearn all your grammar and so on to be able to make sense of it. Sorry? Yeah, even perhaps even a bit harder than Chaucer. Yeah, but it's difficult to compare, but yeah, something like that. I mean, Chaucer is still, Chaucer's Middle English, isn't it? So Chaucer, I think, is still comprehensible, but Beowulf is really like another language. Yeah, no, nor have I, but that's what I heard. Okay, a fully versed in natural philosophy. Padako is the skilled in philology and grammar. Where are we going? Okay, philology. Padako is from the, is the, knowing the roots of words, the pada, the feet of words, presumably. And vyakarano is grammar. And lokayata, natural philosophy, cosmology, something like cosmology, and the brands, the marks of a great man. Okay, and so this is very interesting, is that this teaching on the 32 marks of a great man in the Buddhist scriptures is always said to be a Brahmanical scripture, and it's always the Brahmins who are learning this thing, and it's always supposed to be this big deal among the Brahmins, but there's no mention of it in any Brahmanical scriptures that we actually have, as far as I'm aware. So it's very unusual in that respect. All of the other parts of the Brahmanical literature is in fact the kinds of things we find there, but the great marks of a great man is absent. It's possible that the Buddhists so successfully trumped the whole teaching on the marks of a great man that the Brahmins got a bit embarrassed and just dropped off the whole thing and got lost. So, but yeah, anyway, no, as far as I'm aware, there's no trace of it in the Brahmanical scriptures.
Do Brahmins have any form of fortune telling?
They could do, yeah.
They could do.
Some of them, yeah. Okay, while the very senior Brahmins were conversing with the Blessed One, he repeatedly broke in and interrupted their talk. The Blessed One rebuked the student, saying, "You shouldn't break in and interrupt the talk. Wait until they're speaking." When they finished speaking, then the Brahmin Chanki said to the Buddha, "Don't rebuke the student. He's very learned. He has a good delivery. He's wise. He can take part in this discussion." Then the Blessed One thought, "Surely, since the Brahmins honour him thus, the Brahmin student Kapatika must be accomplished in the scriptures of the three Vedas." Buddha here relying on inference rather than reading his mind. Yeah. Then the Brahmin student Kapatika thought, "When the ascetic Gotama catches my eye, I shall ask him a lesson. I shall ask him a question." And one wonders how they knew what he was thinking at the time. Then reading, Buddha read the guy's mind, then he turned his eye towards him, and then he said, "I'll ask him a question." And he said the following question, "Regarding those ancient Brahmin hymns," okay, which is presumably mantra, "that have come down through oral transmission, preserved in the collection," okay, so iti hiti parampara, okay, so here we notice these words similar to what we found before, iti hiti ha, okay, and the parampara. And Pitaka Sampadaya. Alright? So here those phrases which in the Kalama Sutta was just given in a very general sense, they're now specifically being applied to the Brahmanical scriptures. Alright? Giving the context for those. So this is why it's always useful to come back to the Pali, because if you read it in translation, especially in different translations, then you just wouldn't pick up these connections. The Brahmins come to the definite conclusion. Only this is true, everything else is silly. Yidameva satchang moghamanyam. Alright? And so the word moga, used to translate as wrong or false, but has a stronger meaning than that. It's related to the root of moha, deluded. So everything else is just deluded or ridiculous or something like that. It's stronger than saying it's merely incorrect. Yeah? What is the Buddha say about this? Well, he says, "Is there among the Brahmins just one Brahmin, eka brahmanopi, meaning just one, who says this? I know this, I see this, only this is true, everything else is false. Ahametang janami, ahametang pasami." Okay? So this is this return to the idea of direct vision of the truth, which of course is so characteristic of Buddhism and the other Shramana religions. No, Master Gotama. How many Brahmins? Among the Brahmins, is there even a single teacher or a single teacher teacher? back to the seventh generation of teachers who says this. I know this, I see this, only this is true, everything else is wrong. He says, no, Gotama. How then, Bharadvaja, the ancient Brahman seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, those ancient hymns that were formerly chanted, uttered and compiled. Okay, so where are we going here? So this is an interesting passage. Mantaparan. Okay, those previous Isayo, the rishis, who were the makers of the mantras, the constructors or the creators, the composers of the hymns, those ancient hymns that were formerly chanted in the ancient times, Gita, Pavutta, recited, compiled, Samahita, and the Brahmins these days now, Anu Gayanti, recite along with that, Anu Bhasanti, okay, Bhasitam Anu Bhasanti, reciting along with that, reciting as it was recited before. So again, this use of the word the Anu is reminding us of the Anu Savana that we met in the Kalama Sutra also, what is heard along with, heard from before. So this is referring to what's recited along with, recited from before. That is to say, and then here have the very interesting list of the ancient rishis. Attaka, Vamaka, Vamadeva, Vesamitta, Yamatagi, Angirasa, Bharadvaja, Vasyattha, Kasapa, Bhagu. So this is a standard list in the Pali scriptures of the ancient Vedic sages. Let's see if we can put his note here. Yeah, I'd have to look at that in detail. I think generally speaking, yes. Certainly there is the idea that the Vedas were compiled or actually they like visioned or seen by a smallish number of ancient rishis. And the Vedas are compiled according to the verses of those particular rishis, and certainly some of the names are the same. Whether they're all exactly the same, I'm not quite sure. I think Jayatilekha would have gone into that as well. Okay, so certainly the kind of thing that you find in these things. Did those ancient Brahman singers say thus, we know this, we see this, only this is true, everything else is wrong? And he answered, no, Master Gotama. So, interesting that this analysis of the ancient scriptures, that in the present day, you've got further and further and further and further from the actual thing, and the further you get from the actual thing, the more insistent you are on the truth of it. Yeah? Even the original seers, that's not what they were saying, right? But the further you get away from it, the more insistence there is upon, and of course that's very true with the whole fundamentalist movement today, the further you get from the actual scriptures, you could say exactly the same thing about the Bible. Does the Bible say that it alone is the sole, complete, exactly accurate testament of the Word of God? Well, no, of course the Bible doesn't say that, but that's what Christians today will say about it. So, the Buddha says, so Bharadvaja, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. What do you think, Bharadvaja? That being so, does not the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? So, Buddha not perhaps... not perhaps. He's feeling a bit like Dhammika was when he wrote that article on Amazon.
referred to the Brahmin student named Kapatika.
Yeah.
And then all the way through the Buddha refers to him as
Bharadvaja. Yeah. It's just his family name.
Oh, okay.
So Bharadvaja is one of the sages of the past. Yeah, that was mentioned in the rishis. One of them is Bharadvaja, and so his personal name is Kapatika, and then his family name is Bharadvaja. And the name Bharadvaja is a very common Brahmanical name. And interesting etymology: the dwa is two, ja is born, so it means twice born. Yeah, and this is the one of the ideas of the Brahmins, that they believe they're twice born because they're born from the mother's womb, but they're also born of the mouth of Brahma. And Bahara relates to the, of course, Mahabharata. Yeah, and Bahara literally means burden, and it seems that according to Vijayasekhar's analysis of Bahara and the etymology of it, it's very interesting that he said that the original meaning of Bahara was booty. Right? So it's what the Aryans got when they raided all the settled villages in their chariots, and they made off with all the booty, which was the Bahara, and that's what they carried as their burden around with them. And so that epithet of Bahara originally meant those who were successful at raiding and capturing the stuff of others. This is where Bahara came into the Indian language. So that's what it means, is son of thieves, basically. It might be like Australian heritage. Okay. And so doesn't your faith turn out to be amulika? Again, you know, clearly contrasting with the idea of the akaravati, the reasoned faith. Okay? And poor old Kapatika sort of got himself in a bit slightly deep waters here. But he doesn't try to defend it, that statement. He says, we don't just rely on faith, okay? Not just sadhayeva, but also anusava. We also rely on anusava, yeah? As an oral tradition. We also, so here's again one of the words from the Kalama Sutta. Bharadvaja, first you took your stand on faith, now you speak of oral tradition. There are five things, Bharadvaja, that may turn out in two different ways, here and now. Right? Dvedha vipaka. Two kinds of vipaka. What five? Faith. So here we now, Taneshwara's translation, Nyanamoli's translation have here. Faith, sadha, ruchi, preference, anusava, hearsay learning, or oral tradition. Akara parivitaka, yeah, the reflection on causes or reasoned cogitation or whatever. Dittini jana kanti, reflective acceptance of a view or acceptance of a view after pondering. Yeah. They may turn out in two ways here and, okay, here and now. Now something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty, hollow and false. But something else may not be fully accepted out of faith, and yet it may be factual, true and unmistaken. And something may be fully approved of, it may be well transmitted, it may be well cogitated or well pondered, but it may be empty, hollow and false. But something else may not be well pondered, yet it may be factual, true and unmistaken. In these circumstances it's not proper for a wise man who preserves truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, nothing else, everything else is wrong. Okay. So this is the person who is guarding and preserving the truth. The Pusena Satchamanuraka, the preserving of truth. A wise person, again, the Vinyuna Purisa. Okay, so this is the Vinyu, what is accepted by the Vinyu Purisa was also in the Kalama Sutta. So this means somebody who's a thoughtful person, yeah, somebody who's reflective, somebody who's reasonable.
Like in the Vinyu Iti.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, in the recitation of the Dhamma, yeah. Pachatangveditabo Vinyuhi, one who's accepted by the wise. So it's not appropriate, not enough, not alam. Here is not enough. Ekang sena. One-sided, ekansa, yeah? Your answer is your shoulder, one-sided. Nittang gandum, to come to a conclusion. And again, we met this in the previous sutta, yeah? That the noble disciple has come to that conclusion, yeah? Has drawn the conclusion. It's literally what it means. Nittang is a conclusion, gandum to go. So it's not appropriate to come to a one-sided conclusion. So it's very, you know, you can see why these passages have been very much taken up by the modernist Buddhist movement. They're very modern sounding idioms. Yeah, it's not appropriate for a thoughtful person to come to a one-sided conclusion. Yeah, it's not sufficient to come to a one-sided conclusion.
So, interestingly, it's difficult to accept when I started reading the sutras was that things were blamed by the wise and being accepted by the wise, because it brings in that subject development. That's a very thing the Buddha's deliberately doing.
Yep.
That saying it's not just all these objective things that you can do, actually, there's this subjective inner development that happens. That's what's seen by that inner view, from that inner view, actually does matter.
Yeah. And that, and then when you're using that as an external standard, then that also comes back to the Vimamsaka Sutta. That what you mean by the wise is not, say, somebody who's conventionally said to be wise, but somebody who you investigate and ask, are they wise? And over a long time, and in terms of their actions and their speech and all of these things. And if after that you come to have trust in them as a wise person, then their word has some credibility.
And there's a symbiotic relationship between the objective and the subjective, the inner and the outer, and they can't confirm each other, but you can't rely on anyone in particular.
Yeah. It's very nuanced, isn't it? Go on. Yeah. Okay. Then Kapatika now asking, in what way is there the preservation of truth, the guarding of truth, that Shana Rakana, and how does one guard truth? We ask about the preserving of truth. Now this is a very important one. If a person has a certain faith, he preserves truth when he says, my faith is thus. Sadha Chepi Bharavaja Purisasa Hoti Evan Me Sadhati. By speaking this you guard truth. But you don't by that come to the one-sided conclusion, only this is true, everything else is false. If you have a certain preference, then a person guards truth by saying, this is my preference. But you don't, just on that, come to a one-sided conclusion, only this is true, everything else is false. If a person has a reliance on an oral tradition, if they have a reflective reflection on causes or reasons, if they have the reflective acceptance of a view after pondering it, then you say, I have this acceptance of a view after pondering it, but you don't, by that extent, say, come to the one-sided conclusion, only this is true, everything else is false. This is how you guard the truth. Okay? So it's a very, very important principle. And that essentially is the same principle similar application principle is what Wikipedia is based on, actually. When he was setting up Wikipedia, he had this exact problem, how do we discern what's true and what's not true on the Wikipedia side? And then he realised, well, you can't do that. So all you can do is you can say what's referenced and what's not referenced. Yeah. So all you can say is that this particular statement was made by this person at a certain time, but that's how you preserve the truth. So you can't attest to the authority of it, to the truth of it, but you can say, well, this is there's a view that such and such a person has. And that's the basis of Wikipedia.
Which is actually the case for everything.
So that's the scaling back. When they designed Wikipedia, this is what he did. He scaled it back. He said, we're not going to try to get the truth. What we're going to try is to get something that's referenced. And so you accept that kind of limited thing. And then there are other forums for people who want to do new speculations and new views and things. But that's the forum for something that's referenced.
Opposed to the original idea. But
your reference can be your own research. Do you know what happened?
It could be your own. We went down to the cave and we saw the glow moons, but that's another site for glow moons. Because I was reading Wikipedia on glow moons, and so the legend is that and the other place. And I think quite
of course, yeah.
You know, because
in that case, it's not controversial. Yeah.
I think
I could write in my blog, I
but
have the pain on Tuesday, so the glow of it.
But then you log in pain.
Yeah, but in again, I mean, the idea in Wikipedia would be that that kind of simple factual statement wouldn't be controversial, so that would be to put that. But if you then said the glowworms are there because the cave has become damper and they enjoy the damp environment, then you would want a reference for that. So it really depends what kind of thing you're putting there. Yeah?
The question of reference also brings out how we don't realise how much faith we actually need just to operate on a day-to-day level. So, you know, in the modernist discourse of faith versus rationalism, like there's science equated with rationalism, say, but what most people don't realise is that in order to, say, operate your car, you need to have faith that the mechanics of the car work and being created by people who understand the mathematics, etc., etc., all these things that we ourselves haven't confirmed and worked for ourselves. But then it goes even deeper, so that at the very deepest level, even our direct experience, we need to have the faith that we're not just imagining things. You know, our consciousness has some kind of truth to it, but you always need to contextualise your truth within the parameters of your knowledge.
Yep.
So I know because of my consciousness, but I have the faith that my consciousness is... Well, you just need to always limit it by saying it's not the absolute truth, but it's a kind of knowledge that arises from this particular context.
Yep. Yep.
The faith in developed ideas and the faith in the ideas that keeps moving, that you know, than just confined it to one kind of realisation of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the flip side of that is alien abductions.
That's a good side, right?
Obviously. Yeah, and and conspiracy theories generally. So, like, alien abductions is like, if you look at the accounts of alien abductions, you sort of you sort of go unconscious and you've got a vague memory of disappearing into a kind of a white space with bright lights, and then people with masks and things take instruments and cut you up and do things to you and come out. I think that what's happening there is that's a subconscious fear of hospitals. Yeah? And it's exactly what happens when you have a hospital, and I think you have the subconscious fear and it manifests, it comes out as that fear of alien abductions. And because how do you know what they're actually doing to you when you go into a hospital? You know, you have to have trust in them. But we've all heard stories of things that go wrong. And I think that's very pervasive. That's very pervasive in modern culture, is that we're completely cut off by layers and layers and layers of trust in everything. Like, is this table toxic? Yeah? We don't know. So we're cut off by layers and layers, and so I think that there's a very kind of subtle sort of existential fear and doubt which actually manifests as these kind of projections, that what's actually happening beside the scene is actually like all these conspiracies and all of these kinds of things. It's my theory anyway.
Your theory of alien abductions?
My theory of alien abductions, yeah.
I've never heard of
alien abductions. Well,
alien abductions.
Exactly, yeah. That's not to say that there aren't alien abductions. It's just to say that it might also have a psychological component to the phenomenon as well. Don't want to be reductive about it. Okay, let's go.
We're inferential.
Okay.
So,
no, that's not what this passage here is saying. This passage here is saying that you preserve truth when you simply represent what it is. If you have faith, you say, it's my faith. If it's my reasoning, you say, it's my reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So like just now I said, well, that's my theory. Yeah? So I wasn't saying, this is definitely true. I was just saying, this is my theory.
So sort of recognising where it comes from.
Yeah? What means of knowledge does this come from? It's like just... This is it. Yep. I read it on Wikipedia, therefore. Well, that's different. We'll come to that one later. Okay. Okay, next. Okay, gentle persons, I know it's getting a bit late, but we're just coming to the resolving and the answering of all the questions that we've just had, okay? So let's just go into that. Okay, then the Buddha says, in this way you guard the truth, but there is no, not yet any satjana bodha, not any realization of the truth, okay? Any awakening to the truth. Okay, so he says, how do you discover the truth? Okay, then it goes to and it talks about an inquiry. So somebody who goes and inquires about a monk based on similar things that we read in the Vimamsaka Sutta. Do they have greed, hatred and delusion? Do they act in a harmful way and so on? If they don't find those states based in the monk, then they and they're teaching a good Dhamma and they've investigated in that way, they've investigated them in regard to greed, hatred and delusion, then they place faith in them. Okay, so once you've investigated in regard to greed, hatred and delusion, you place faith, lobha, dosa, mohanisadamesu, sadhang niveseti. Okay. Filled with faith, he visits him. Sadhajato, with the arising of faith, he approaches him. He pays respects to him. Okay, approaching him, he pays respects. Paying respects, he lends an ear. Okay, bends his ear. Listens to what he's having to say. When he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Okay? Having heard the Dhamma, he dhareti. He remembers it. Remembering the Dhamma, he attang upa parikati. Examines the meaning of it. Okay? Examining the meaning of it, he... Okay, here's the passage here. Examining the meaning of it, he nidhanang kamanti. Okay, so he accepts with pondering that Dhamma. Okay, accepts the Dhamma with pondering. So here's the same words we found previously, yeah? The hearing, so on, you've heard from another, you found a respected teacher, yeah? Samano no Garu. All of these things that were found in the Kalama Sutta, we're now also finding them here. But, of course, we're not finding them and saying just one of them is sufficient for a definitive arrival at truth. Then, by accepting, when he's accepted the teachings as a result of pondering them, desire springs up. Right. Chando jayati. That means you fall in love with the teacher. No. It means you have a desire, interest to practice the teachings. When the desire has sprung up, he applies his will, usahati. Sati here is it's not mindfulness. Here sati is it's one of the forms of the verb to be. Okay, so when there is this, then it's a locative case, yeah. This being so, then this happens. Yeah. Santi, isn't it? Santi is a plural or the same thing, yeah. Chando Jayati, when he strives, then having strived the mind, he scrutinizes. Duleti, yeah? Scrutinizing, he strives more. Resolutely striving. Ahitato. Samano. Kayena. Cheva parama satchang sachikaroti. He realizes the ultimate truth, literally, with his body. So this is one of the idioms that I discussed in the module on the weekend. Literally, he witnesses the ultimate truth with his body. So in phrases like this, the word body has this implication of like a direct, immediate experience. Okay? And it's often used in a samadhi context with this same word, sachikaroti.
Is this the body witness?
Exactly the same phrases, yeah? Body witness is kaya, sakhi. with the same thing, yeah? And it has that meaning, one the direct, immediate, personal experience. It's an idiom. That's the implication. It's used very commonly in the context of someone who's developing samadhi, that you with your body you realize or touch that particular state or something like that. So to contrast somebody who's maybe heard about that state or something with somebody who's directly experienced it for themselves. Yeah. It's an idiom, but the word for kaya, the word for body, has this kind of gradual evolution of meanings from a more subtle kind of the coarse material body, then to like kind of a subtle body or bliss body kind of idea, and here is like almost even beyond that. You know, it's like a body of truth, a body of realization. It's actually a bit similar to the Mahayana usage, where they have the three kaya. The nirmana kaya is the physical manifestation. Sambhoga kaya is the enjoyment body, which is like the samadhi body, and the dharma kaya is the highest one. Breath body again is kind of one of the stages along that development. It's like it's quite a subtle progression in the way it's used. Yeah.
So in this context, even the body, if it was a body witness, would refer to the first through to the eighth jhana group, plus the attainments of Nirodha
Samapatti. I think a body witness itself is like a isn't I think it's a kind of one of the. It's defined as like is it a Sakadagami and Anagami?
Mm.
I think it may be who's got the eight attainments or something like that.
The ninth.
Don't think the ninth. Ninth is usually just the Anagami moving to Arahant. I think.
Anagami have the capacity of
that cessation. Yeah, possibly it's a bit of a complex thing. But anyway, it's somebody. Kayasaki is somebody who's on the path. And who's with for whom samadhi is predominant. That's the basic idea.
Would it be inferring here, like a direct experience? Very empirical.
Yep.
As opposed to, what's the opposite of body witness being?
Body witness is the.
One liberated by wisdom.
Not quite, but it's on the same track, it's on the same path, yeah. So the kind of body witness is contrasted with the. I can't remember now. And where are we going now? He realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating with wisdom. So panyaya chatnam ati vijha pasati. Okay? So that can be read as emphasizing both the samadhi aspect and the wisdom aspect of realization. So here's that movement. So here, hopefully, this, and then to this extent that there is the realization of truth. Okay?
To this extent.
Yeah. But there is as yet no final arrival at truth. And at this point you're thinking, blimey.
I think it's ditti.
Ditti, yeah. Ditti pato, yeah? Yeah, that's right. The one who's wisdom is a ditti pato. So hopefully this little passage is going to resolve some of those difficulties that we had before about the means of knowledge, yeah? And so here all of them are part of that path, part of that gradual progression. Not the final arrival, but each step of the way is tested and is seen, and gradually you keep on going. And so how is there then the final arrival at truth? Okay. So then, what is that? Final arrival at truth, Bharadvaja, lies in the, where are we? Okay, in the repetition, development, and cultivation of these same things. So it's not as interesting an answer as we might have hoped for, but. Okay, tesanyeva, the very same things. Dhamana asevana bhavana bahuli kama satanupati hoti. The point here is that what's been referred to previously is one of the earlier stages of the path, maybe stream entry or something like that. And stream entry is always an actual direct vision of the truth. So you actually do see the truth. And it says that you see the paramasaccha, you see the highest truth. Yeah. So that's that's clear, but it's not yet completely embodied and completely fulfilled. So then you keep doing exactly the same things, and it's important to remember that there's no change in the path from the path to lead to stream entry to the path that you continue on. And again, this is something you sometimes find in modern Buddhism, where they say you don't need jhanas to get stream entry, but you do need jhanas after stream entry to get higher stages. This is one version of the Vipassana Vada, and this kind of statement, which is absolutely standard throughout the suttas, is that the path you get to stream entry is exactly the same thing as you keep on doing. Tesan yeva dhammanang asevana bhavana bahulikamma. And so this is like the further development and cultivation of the path. And also notice that this is what these words mean. Asevana bhavana. So when we talk about bhavana, it means making more of something. So it's already there. The stuff's already there. You're making more of it.
So okay. Is development a good term for bhavana?
Development's a bit ambiguous because it can mean bringing something into being from nothing.
Creating.
Yeah, so you know, you develop a new suburb means that there wasn't a suburb before and there is now.
So progression would that be more appropriate?
Progression, perhaps, yeah. It's a bit,
moving from one state to another.
It's a bit difficult to find a good idiom, yeah. Enhancement, amplification, perfection. Yeah? Something like that?
But it would be correct to say that with all the different aspects, they're holographic, in the sense that you don't say, I'm at step one, I'm only going to do step one, but actually all the steps are actually part of step one, and the full development of step one, and so you're kind of doing everything at the same time.
To emphasise in different parts, yeah. It's not certainly not, you know, it's never a hard and fast linear separation of those things, but there's also there's also definitely an emphasis, you know, when you first start and you have to really listen. Yeah, and then as you go more and you can more practicing. Okay. Then the response is, in that way we recognize the final arrival at truth. But what is the most helpful? What is the most helpful in the question now? For the arriving at truth. Bahukaro, what's helpful? Striving is the most helpful for arriving at truth. What's helpful for striving? Scrutiny. What's helpful for scrutiny? Applying the will. What's helpful for applying the will? Desire, chanda. And so, of course, working backwards here through the same dhammas that we met before. Accepting the teachings as a result of pondering them is most helpful for desire. If you don't accept the teachings as a result of pondering them, desire will not spring up. Teaching, what's helpful for that is reflecting on the teachings. What's helpful for reflecting on the teachings is memorizing the teachings. What's helpful for memorizing the teachings? Listening to the dhamma. What's helpful for listening to the dhamma? Lending an ear, right? Paying attention. What's useful for lending an ear? Paying respect. Yeah, because when you approach the teacher in the right way, then they'll see that you have a good attitude, they want to teach. What's helpful for paying respect? Visiting. If you don't visit a teacher, you can't pay respect to them. What's helpful for visiting? Faith. Okay? So again, just coming back to that, again to show that the, you know, again, contrary to the kind of the modernist interpretation of the Kalama Sutra, it says, you know, don't have faith but have reason. That's not what we're finding here at all. What we're finding here is faith is one of the most helpful things. It's a certain stage in development. That faith is already based on reflection and so on, and step by step, but that's very helpful for visiting, which is helpful for listening, which is helpful for memorizing, which is helpful for investigating, which is helpful for reflecting, which is helpful for acceptance, which is helpful for desire, which is helpful for scrutiny, which is helpful for striving, and then striving is helpful for realizing the truth.
So George Michael had it right. You've got to have faith. A great Buddhist philosopher, George Michael.
He's got the other way. So it's going from top down, yeah? Whereas some in the other places where it says that, when you go to see the Buddha or monk as a teacher, that you need to do these things, and then by doing that, then you get to the truth.
Yep. It's essentially turning upside down the whole gradual training.
Because he's trying to present the truth first, and then the means of how you come to that truth.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, a bit of a point. me about the after pondering the teachings, desire spring up, and then your planning to be what sort of desire, and then why is it
conducted? Desire, because you when you hear the teachings, you know, someone's saying, you know, look, if you meditate, then you know you'll be able to overcome the stresses, and you'll be able to realize peace of mind and see the truth. So you think, oh, okay, that sounds good. I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There also brings a nuance to the idea that Buddhism is not desire, and any other desire is bad.
So that's right. That's right. The desire that's motivated in the right direction.
Mm.
So not
No, actually, the word chanda is used here, and it's the same word that we had in the previous sutta for the attachment, personal attachment, was chandaraga. So it's actually used very widely. You have to see it according to context. In that sense, it was, yeah. So that makes it more explicit. But yeah, it's used in so many ways. Chanda is used very, very broadly. Yeah. Yep. One of the Udipadas. Yep.
So, he's saying that faith and reason and everything is okay, but it's not the end by itself.
It's not the end by itself, yeah.
You have to use kind of all of them.
You use all of them, use them in a balanced way, yeah. You use them in a humble way, like a modest way, yeah, and a reflective way. So you're constantly reflecting on the, you know, say your faith isn't blind faith or whatever, but it's reflective, investigative, and then it's neither the end, but nor is it something which is superfluous. So you have to have.
Sometimes it's thinking of doing something.
The realizing with the body the ultimate truth and sees it by the penetrating with understanding. It's up here. So realize with the body the ultimate truth.
What does that phrase mean, Dante? Realize with the body? Is that to say with direct experience here and now?
Yep. And this is just as a doctrinal point, this word, the ultimate truth, paramattha satya, they use a lot in the Abhidhamma and so on. This is a similar phrase, and it's not paramattha, it's just paramasatya. I'm not sure if paramattha satya appears, but this is the only context that it appears in. So the ultimate truth is not, in the Vipassana schools, the ultimate truth is regarded as two categories. One is the realities of experience, so the realities of, say, the five khandhas, or the ultimate dhammas, and also the seeing of the truth with the realization of the Four Noble Truths. But he, in the suttas, it only means the latter. It only means actually seeing the Four Noble Truths.
And again, the ultimate truth is not there until you actually explicit.
Yep.
You still can't claim to know.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
a very similar approach, isn't it? Yeah, the smaller discourse on the elephant's footprint. Yeah, yeah, and that uses some of the same language, the nittang gacchati of arrival at truth. Yeah, so that's another one. If you're interested in this, check out the smaller discourse on the elephant's footprint in the Majjhima Nikaya. That has a similar.
Yeah, because I think if it's not this subject, then maybe that subject you just mentioned, the bigger word actually is a good class on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we can have a look on the birding one state. So he explains more details about the etymologies and what that says about the Brahmins land. And
also he talks
about the what is it that means by body. And sometimes he talks about it. I'm sure it's that one or another one. But
okay.
I think it's a good way of explaining. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Birdingmonastery.net, and you can go from there and find that. Because this whole book is originally based on classes which he gave, And so because you've got a lot of feedback or about a systematic way in which the classes were taught, that you quite inspired to do this book. And that's what it's based on, so if you'd like, you can have a look on that website and have a look at all the talks that you've seen.
Okay.
I wasn't quite sure I understand what you meant when you comment on the mind moment that people talk about and what you referred in the sutra before.
Mm-hmm.
That just doing the present moment when you think about the past. I didn't really understand.
Okay. I mean that comment was really just it's an orientation problem. It's an orientation problem because when you come, as I did, from your kind of basic training in the kind of the modern Vipassana schools, they present things in a certain way, and that's regarded as being the definitive idea on things. And so it's important that when we're coming to read the suttas and so on, that we can learn to deconstruct that. So that's the reason why I was making that point. If you haven't come from that background, the point probably doesn't have any use, okay? But the point is this, if you go to Vipassana schools and so on, then what they'll teach you is that the present moment basically is like a mind moment, so it's just, and when you say contemplating the present moment or doing something in the present moment, what it actually means is that very kind of instant on the cutting edge of that kind of one mind moment of experience. That's the present moment. So it's a very sharp, very focused, very narrow idea of what the present moment is. It's very precise. Yeah? And it's just important to bear in mind that when we read the talking about it in the suttas, that it's not necessarily using it in exactly the same sense. So in that sutta where it's talking with that Brahman, It wasn't talking in that specific technical sense of the present moment. It was just more kind of a general thing. Well, right now, here we're sitting here, you know, if somebody that you knew died, you know, would you be upset by that? Yeah? And so it's more of a kind of, it's a kind of a broader, more kind of natural language use of the present moment rather than that very specific technical usage. Yeah? Does that make sense? Yeah? It's just to be aware of how they're used in different contexts, that's all.
So, in that case, how could the later concept of having broader awareness of the present moment could be applied in practice? Like, how would they change the direction of the practice? Or, like, for example, even within the Pasha, if you put your focus a bit more broader, then how would
Well, look, you could do that, but that's not quite what the sutta was actually doing. The sutta was more of a discussion thing, yeah? And it was discussing with someone, well, what you think if somebody knew. So I'm just retaining that context.
Yeah.
See, the thing is that those ideas are appropriate to apply in different ways in different contexts.
Mm.
Yeah? So if you're doing that Vipassana practice, then that's exactly what you want to do. You want to have that very narrow, sharp practice. So it's not saying that you should apply it in that broad way in that context, but it's just pointing out that there are these different contexts, that's all.
But I guess the same methodology of practice can be applied into a broader context, like not just very narrow, you know, to the very moment, but to, like, for example, remembering something and then checking, you know, your, pandas or girls
or something.
Like, it's also kind of
You can broaden it out. See, in the sense of, so for example, like reflecting on, say, how things change. So, for example, you could reflect on, I thought about this, you know, I thought about that argument that I had, and then this tension came up in my body, you know?
Yeah.
So then that's a, that's a broader, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I'm original understanding of the personal practice, but when you mentioned that, I was a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I know that they are stressed more on the very narrow, even on the dot, to the present moment.
Yeah. But you'll find, of course, you'll also find different teachers emphasizing it in different ways. So that's just my experience was from that. Yeah. Again, I'm not trying to say that that's wrong. I'm just trying to say that just to understand it in different ways in different contexts. That's all. Tata, exactly.
I think one teacher is, you know, outstandingly talking about the person that's like, you know, what can we do? And just been, you know, the practice.
Yeah.
In a way, isn't it the same present moment, but it's just a scenery?
Not necessarily, no, and that's an assumption, yeah. If you want to, that's an inference. You can infer that it's the same, but it's quite a different context, yeah. You know, if you say from an Abhidhamma context, ultimate reality is a series of mind moments, each one of which is a billionth of a second, and the present moment means being aware of that billionth of a second, which is actually happening. Yeah, that's what being aware of the present moment. That's a very different way of talking than talking to somebody and say, "Well, look, think about your children in the village. What would happen if they were to be run over by a car? You know, how would you feel then?" Yeah. So it's quite a different way of riding on a horse. You're sitting on a saddle. Yeah, it's got a bit of breadth on it. Yeah.
When you mentioned about that, we can sometimes want like neighbors, children, that sort of thing is not an object.
It's not a meditation object, yeah.
A contemplation object.
Contemplation, yeah. Yeah.
I'm confused you more.
Doubting on a doubtful matter. That's also quite a nice reassurance, isn't it, at the start of the Kalama Sutta. You're doubting about a doubtful matter, you think, oh, that's
surprising. So, sometimes I want the notes of the class, and then if any of you don't want to receive the notes in the future, just let me know.
Okay, thanks a lot. That's good.
Oh, which one are we going to actually do?
I hadn't thought about it. I'll pick a passage. I might pick this passage from the Chanki Sutta. That's maybe the most useful one about the just the dhammas that are leading in the right direction. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah, that's really nice as well. We could maybe do both, a couple of short passages. Yeah.